inside the feral zone.
Greetings, listeners. Welcome back inside the feral zone of the Troubled Men podcast. I am Renee Komen, operating under cover of darkness from inside Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge in the heart of the Clempire. Many of you may know the Feral Zone is a sister podcast of the Troubled Men podcast. It appears in the space from time to time, as is warranted. And tonight, Manny is occupied with some school book depository work, possibly feathering his sniper's nest. That being said, we have a longtime guest host of the Feral Zone, the great Mr. Jeff Treffinger. Welcome, Jeff.
Greetings, Renee. How are you?
I'm good. You may know Jeff Treffinger from his work with as a founder of Tribe Nunzio, founder of the Geraniums, also a guitar player in the Glenn Styler Rock Band, also owner of the Mermaid Lounge, owner of Truck Farm, on and on. We have a new project, Ultraviolet, and I'm kind of letting the cat out of the bag here. It's going to be exciting recording project.
And don't leave out Target of Manny Chevrolet's sniper rifle.
Well, sure. I think we're all in the crosshairs. So that being said, we have a terrific guest tonight. I'm going to go ahead and introduce him right off the bat before we get into our gripes. He's a twice Grammy-nominated drummer, band leader, songwriter, educator, a founding member of the Mardi Gras Indian funk band, Chawa. He's worked with the Wild Magnolias, Art Neville, Preservation Hall Jazz Band, Big Chief Monk Boudreau, Alvin Young Bloodheart, many more. He's also taught many places around the city, NOCA, CAC, Ogden Museum of Southern whatever, Music Box Village. I love the Ogden Museum.
I do, too.
Yeah, all right. Also, he was an on-and-off music director at the NOLA Detox, so you can tell right off the bat we have a lot of things in common. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks for having me, Renee.
Yeah, man. Thanks for making it.
It's my pleasure.
It's a little bit of shifting schedules here, but we all pulled it together.
New Orleans style.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, the Feral Zone, sometimes we get right into it, but since we have a lively group here at the table, I'll go into some of my usual grievances that I need to air. First off, Jeff, you know, you're a builder. You deal with safety and permits department all the time. And you have...
Not all the time.
Not all the time. But I'm sure you are aware of their new Healthy Homes apartment certification.
Oh, yes, I am.
Boondoggle. Mm-hmm. You know, I got notices on two of my properties months ago. I was thinking, oh, I'm just not going to do it. Then I decided, well, here they're going to fine me if I don't do it. So, but I waited one day too long. I thought, maybe they'll let me slide. You think they're going to let me slide?
No.
They're going to charge me
$50. You called me.
I called you, that's right. So I went ahead and filled it out. You know, actually went down there and spoke to them, you know, tried to put the glad hand on them, but and thought maybe it might have worked. Now, then I got a notice the other day that one of my apartments went through. I just have to pay the $50 fine, and they'll give it to me. Then the other one, they said, well, there's an HVAC permit that's hanging this up. I'm like, HVAC permit?
Oh, you have an open permit.
An open permit. What the fuck is an open permit?
It's a permit that wasn't closed.
Well, I mean, why do you need to close it? I mean, like, you get the permit, and then this is from a period of time that I didn't even have any HVAC work done that anybody would pull a permit for.
You know what? We'll go romping through the one-stop shop tomorrow together, and I'll show you.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to talk. You know, this is public.
Right.
This could all come crashing down on both of us.
Oh, yeah.
Careful. You know?
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, this Healthy Home stuff. I don't know. I think they should start with healthy people.
Well, no, I think the healthy home stuff is definitely going to be a nightmare, because you take one of the most corrupt departments and inept departments in the whole city government outside of the executive branch, outside of LaToya Cantrell's actual, you know, operation. Why would you want to invent this whole other regime and put them in charge of it?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question.
Thank you.
And I don't know why. They certainly have gone down a couple notches since COVID. They were on a roll. You know, they were actually...
In a good way?
Improving.
Okay.
Prior to COVID, yeah. It was much more user-friendly. You used to go in there, and it was like... it was like going to a deli. You know, you'd put who you needed to talk to, and you'd sit there and wait, and your name come up, and you go to a desk, and you talk to someone, you get something done.
Okay.
And no more. Now it's like an empty hallway, and nobody comes out. And there's one poor human being at the desk who takes all the grief of every human being in the city who's pissed off, just like you.
Just like me.
Right.
I'm sure I'm not alone.
Only that's their job, is to deal with people like on a conveyor belt of anger.
Right. And just shine them off. You know, it's a haunted department where, who
knows? I wish it was that active.
Yeah. Okay.
Sounds like a great gig.
Yeah.
My daughter works at City Hall now.
Okay. Yeah. My condolences.
Yeah. Well.
No, it's a steady gig. I know you have to kill somebody to get fired from the New Orleans city government. So it's true.
It's lifetime
employment. Well, I was in a parking lot the other day. I was trying to park, and I was actually trying to leave the parking lot, and a woman had driven by, like she's passed me up in the lane. She's going to, you know, down the line looking for another parking space. So I back up slowly. I'm waiting to see, you know, where I can cross into the other lane. Suddenly she throws the car in reverse and backs up into the side of my car.
Oh, man. And it's hot.
Oh, man.
It's hot. And it's summertime.
It was a slow-moving crash, but a crash nonetheless. So now I'm in...
Was she polite?
She was polite. We were both polite. Now, I don't know if she thought somehow that was my fault. We didn't really establish fault, and we just figured, well, you know, this is not a big deal. But now I'm sweating it, man. I'm like, what is she going to tell her insurance company? I have a lawsuit on my hands. I may have to rely on Redmond. I may have to pull out the big guns.
Well, let's see. She's going in reverse in a parking lot.
Yeah, you can't back up into somebody and say, I mean, what? What's the defense?
She didn't know what gear she was in.
Yeah, okay.
And who got the space?
It was not my space. I was in a space. I was leaving. So
I see.
Anyway, it was a very bizarre situation. Enough of that. Back to our guest, the great Mr. Joe Gelini. So you are not from New Orleans.
I am not from New Orleans.
Now, you have the name Gelini, which is Italian,
mm-hmm.
I assume.
Yep.
You know, there's a lot of Italian-sounding names in New Orleans.
Yeah.
But I think that you and our co-host may be some of the few actual real mainland Italians here in New Orleans. Because everybody else is Sicilian, who has an Italian name
in
New Orleans.
Well, actually, my dad's side of the family is... They would say part Sicilian, part Roman.
Okay. All right. So a mixed marriage.
Yeah. It was like, you know, anyone who's Italian understands the dichotomy of, you know, regions.
Right,
like
right,
that.
Right, right. Well, a lot of people in New Orleans understand as well. I have nothing to do with Italy personally, but I'm well acquainted with the geography of the area and the history of the area.
Yeah, I mean, I heard that at one point there were more Sicilians living in New Orleans than living in Sicily, like the turn of the century.
Wow.
Really?
I don't quote me.
Right.
Well, it could be in America, because the Sicilians were brought in after the Great Migration, after the end of slavery. They thought they could use Sicilians as farm laborers.
Yep.
And they underestimated them.
Right. it's a wily bunch.
They underestimated their ability to listen to directions.
Well, I could give you my dad's favorite Italian joke. You want to hear it?
Sure.
Why don't Italians like Jehovah's Witnesses?
Why?
Italians don't like any witnesses.
That's a good one.
That is a good one.
Yeah. Well, so not being from New Orleans, where do you hail from?
So I grew up in New England, Rhode Island and Connecticut, and then, I went to music school in Boston.
Okay, well, tell us about your family. So big Catholic family?
Yeah, I have three younger biological brothers. Actually, one of them lives in New Orleans and is a very successful and talented production manager.
Oh, okay.
And his name is Tom Gelini, and he works over at the Joy Theater, and he tour manages some national acts, and he went to Loyola.
Okay.
And so love that he's here. And
nice.
Then
yes.
I've got two other brothers who live in Santa Monica now in LA, my dad was really responsible for kind of like instilling the love of New Orleans in me.
How was that?
He was president of a broadcasting company at the, you know, towards the end of his career, and he worked his way up, but he was, back in the 90s, there was a broadcasting convention in New Orleans called the NatP convention.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually took me to that when I was on my Christmas break, my first year at Berkeley. But before that, he was always bringing back music from New Orleans and, just kind of like regaling me with talking about Tipitinas and the different restaurants and nightclubs. And I mean, it was just really, really incredible.
Before you'd ever been to New Orleans, you were hearing these tales.
Yeah.
It sounded like Oz or something.
It totally did. I mean, it's, I grew up in this very white, upper middle class, suburb of New York City in Westport, Connecticut. And it was, I have great memories from there, but it was like the antithesis of New Orleans culturally.
Right.
Yeah. So I was really looking for something. I was on a spiritual journey.
Okay.
And
a quest.
Yeah, yes. A quest. And New Orleans really, ever since, has just been, I felt like I lived here in another life.
Interesting. Yes, I know.
But he would always bring them, I was listening to The Meters in high school and Dr. John and the Neville Brothers.
Oh, cool.
And Astro Project and all that.
Now, were you already playing music at that point and like through elementary school and high school?
Yeah, I started really gigging when I was about 16 years old.
So did you come up through the school band program, playing marching band, that kind of
thing? Yeah, I did all that, but then I quickly got involved and I was playing blues and, I was actually gigging and going out and playing at bars when I was 16.
Right, right.
So yeah, I was committed to it immediately.
Sure. Now, friends of yours that you were bringing all these New Orleans records around, Meters, what did they think about all that? Was that...
I used to, we'd play... I remember that when I finally figured out how to play Look a Pie Pie on the drums, I was I invited one of my best friends over who was... he played guitar with me, and he was just... He looked at me, he was like... Whoa. And I had I was like, wait, come here and check this out. I figured it out.
Nice. Yeah, it's precious material, man.
It's like gospel.
Right. What kind of bands were you seeing coming through there? What was your taste outside of the New Orleans thing? Were you into rock and roll, jazz?
Everything. Just sort of the nature of it being growing to high school in the early to mid '90s. It was a lot of rock bands. Nirvana hit when I was a freshman in high school.
Now, were you a fan of Nirvana? I mean, I am.
I am, and you know, Dave Grohl was probably the drummer that first catapulted me into like wanting to actually sit down and listen to CDs and try and tapes and try to figure out exactly how to play those things.
That style.
Yeah.
Now here's something. I haven't heard anybody say this, but I thought it right away. Dave Grohl's drumming style, to me, I can draw a direct line back to Bill Ward from Black Sabbath.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, he's an incredibly musical drummer. And
Dave Grohl. Yes.
And I was just...
And Bill Ward.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, those records were epic. But then that really just kind of like lasted a couple of years for me, because that was, you know, that things moved quickly. And
sure.
Then I got into... you know, I was playing in some blues bands, and you know, I would go to see when I was old enough, I'd go to see the Allman Brothers play their residencies at the Beacon Theater.
Oh, cool.
And we would go to different jazz clubs in New York City. You know, we'd go see like the Mingus Big Band.
Nice.
And stuff like that. They played at the Fez.
Oh, okay.
I don't even know if it's still there, but it was an underground. They had the whole band, like Randy Brecker would play with them. I mean, it was just really, it was really epic. But yeah, so I got exposed to a lot of stuff. I got, you know, then of course there was sort of like the jam band scene, you know, like Fish and the Dave Matthews Band and things like that were all kind of happening concurrently with, you know, I was listening to jazz, and I was listening to all sorts of different music, and you know, spending a lot of time listening to the Meters, and you know, just kind of, I just love music. So
sure, sure.
I've always had a very open-minded approach to.
Yeah. Well, it's a.
To good music.
Why not? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So what was your first band? And what kind of music were you playing when you finally, like, had the soup of your influences, and then whatever friends you had that had, you know, their own skills, and you all came together. What
I mean, the nice thing about where I grew up in Westport, Connecticut, was that a lot of my friends played music, and it was like sort of, it was known for being like sort of a bohemian, like, artist colony. You know, even though I was sort of born with a silver spoon in my mouth, you know, like, Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward lived down the, you know, the street.
Really?
Did you get salad dressing?
Well, I mean, of course. That was a rite of passage.
Did you get to go to their house and hang out with them?
No, but, like, okay. He came to our school one time and did, like, Kids in the Wall or Kids in the...
Kids in the Hall?
No, not Kids in the Hall. I can't remember what his charity was that he did, but I mean, he would, you know, yeah, it was, and Nile Rodgers lived there, Michael
cool.
Bolton lived there, Ashford and Simpson.
Oh wow,
geez, that's quite a neighborhood.
Yeah, no kidding.
What are block parties?
Yeah,
like
Danny Korchmeyer lived there. Keith Richards lived in Weston next door. Just a lot of, you know, and then there were a lot of like. You know, session players that lived in there. So it was always just kind of like we were always in the orbit of these really like amazing musicians.
Now, did you have an opportunity to study with any of these guys when you were in high school, or like take private lessons or
not really. It was sort of like we would, you know, they were, it was, We were kind of too young to like really experience what that would have been like, but
okay.
But yeah, it was a pretty incredible place. I remember I got so mad at my dad when I was in like I must have been like a 16 years old, and he was like, my friend invited me over to. His neighbor's house, where the drummer from Mountain and Noel Redding were just jamming in the basement.
Cool.
And my dad was like, "No, you can't go. It's a school night." And you know,
oh.
that resentment will
sure.
carry well, for my whole
life. I understand. Yeah, I have a few of those too. My father showed up at Old Man Rivers and dragged me out of the parking lot when I was about to see the Ramones.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
now, you were on the West Bank then, right? You were in Algiers?
Yeah, I was in Algiers, but somebody picked me up again. It was a school night. I went without permission. My parents had gone to run an errand somewhere. I just took off and was gone. You know, they didn't know where I was. Well, maybe I left a note saying I went to see the Ramones or something like that. But I just secured somebody's ID, an actual ID that kind of looked like me.
Right.
And I was about to go use that, and I'm kind of jogging across the parking lot, and a car pulls up right in front of me, and it's my father. He rolls down the window, he goes get in the fucking car.
Wow.
So I mean, but if you remember that period of time, like in the early 90s, early to mid 90s, there was a period where from like I want to say 1993 or 4 to like 1995, Kurt Cobain committed suicide, and Jerry Garcia died in the summer of, I think it was the summer of 1995. And
take your word for it.
And just that shift in the world of music, it became like, I remember I was going to see the Grateful Dead, and then when Jerry died, that was a gigantic scene amongst itself. And then I remember that summer, and Fish sort of started filling the void of some of those, you know, the lifestyle of that.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, we'd go see like a ton of live music. And so it's really interesting just to think on a certain level that like from 1993, like, you know, it was like Kurt Cobain, he died. That was sort of like the end of an era. And then Jerry died a couple years later. That was the end of an era. And, you know, all of these different changes were happening just within a few years of each other. And it was really interesting just to be, you know, at least like a teenager and kind of be able to, you know, have a little bit of a taste of all that.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. So you graduate from high school, you go to Berkeley. Now, did you know other people that had gone to Berkeley, or what was your experience with
Berkeley?
That
was an
idea?
Interesting situation because
Berklee College of Music, and for any of our listeners, that we're not talking about the Berklee in California, Berklee in Boston.
I'm not that much of an academic.
No, I'm just explaining to our non-musician friends out there in the
I didn't go to the University of California. You know, Berklee is one of the most esteemed, you know, music schools in the country, in the world. And you know, what was interesting was that I was spending a lot of time in Boston when I was a teenager because my mother was terminally ill. Wow. And she had her doctors up at UMass. Mm-hmm. And hospital, and Mass General Hospital. Mm-hmm. And so I spent a ton of time, and my grandparents lived in Boston, and my dad used to work in Copley Square in Boston. So I was very familiar with Boston and had a lot of time on my hands. And I would go to Berklee, and I felt like I was like sneaking into a club, but I would literally go down into the basement of the percussion department and just listen and like sort of audit all of these classes that were happening, but just by like I had my ear against the door.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't difficult to hear them. I mean, they were, you know, the walls weren't insulated very well. Right. And it was like fantasy land for me.
Yeah.
I just was absolutely like blown away. And I don't know that I had any other music school that I even wanted to go to. You know, there was like North Texas State, and there's Miami, and you know, some of the conservatories. But just Berklee to me seemed like this dream come true.
Okay.
And I just I put all my eggs in one basket.
Nice. I like that.
Is the only place you applied to?
I think I applied to UMass just to have
a fallback.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, what happened...
Safety school.
What happened was actually I got in on a provisional basis. They said that I had to... Because I was a drummer, mm-hmm. I hadn't really had a lot of... music theory experience, and because Berkeley doesn't discriminate, they make everybody do the same core curriculum. Uh-huh. And they would say, like, well, we have a lot of problems with drummers dropping out because they haven't learned any theory. So I had to go to a 5-week summer program that they had, which was like really, really fun. But I passed. I got the I got into Berkeley. I found out, I think, it was only a few weeks before the semester started, but I got in, and the rest is history.
Now, what kind of do you wind up studying with some amazing teachers there, I'd imagine? Anybody that we would know of, or anybody you'd want to mention in particular?
Well, I think the first thing that really was like that. There were a couple things that were like that literally happened like just within the orbit of Berkeley that were really sort of life changing for me. Boston and Cambridge has this really amazing, at least they did when I was there, scene of like touring jazz musicians. So mm-hmm. there were like a lot of jazz clubs, and I remember seeing John Scofield when I was 18. And I was kind of thinking like, oh, I'm going to see some like wild fusion drummer like Dennis Chambers or, Dave Weckl or Vinnie Colaiuta. And it was Idris Muhammad.
Oh, okay.
Who recorded on the Groovelation album that came out that year. And it was like Larry Goldings and Idris Muhammad and John Scofield. And anyways, it was the first time that I'd ever seen in person someone play like in the New Orleans drumming style.
Okay.
And I was obsessed.
Yeah.
just jaw dropping to the floor. Like if he had started like levitating over the drum throne, I wouldn't have been surprised.
Yeah.
Because that was it was just like a seismic shift in my whole concept of the role of the drums and how you could even play them.
Yeah. Now, was he playing some tambourine as well?
He was, what the great part about it was that I went, this is, what had actually happened was, that my mother passed away in my first semester at Berkeley. And I went back to, this happened during my midterms. And so I missed my midterms, and then I had to go back to, I decided to go back. Wasn't forced to, but I decided that would be the best thing for me. And I went back, I took my midterms, and then my dad was taking me and my brothers like on vacation for a week just to kind of like decompress and have some time by ourselves and be able to go through the grieving process. And, it really felt like a spiritual experience. I went to see the band, Scofield's band, the night before I was supposed to, or 2 nights before I was supposed to drive back or be back in Connecticut or take the train back, whatever I was going to do. It was only 3 hours away.
Right.
And I went up to Idris after he played, and I was just like, I probably sounded like I was 5 years old. I was like, yeah, it's great. You're really good,
You're from New Orleans.
Yeah, yeah. So I went up to him, and I was just like, I don't know. I was like desperate to learn about it. So I said, hey, would you consider giving me a drum lesson? And he was like, sure, kid. I'm here all weekend, come pick me up, or just come meet me in the lobby of the hotel at noon and we'll figure it out. And I was like, I went and got a practice space at Berkeley, and I took the T like the to Cambridge,
right.
And met him. He took the subway back with me to Boston across the river. and we did this like 2-hour lesson. We went to Jack's Drum Shop. We did all this stuff, and then he was even late to his lobby call.
Because he was hanging out with you.
Because he was hanging out with me, and it was like, it was just the most amazing thing. And
how generous
he was! Like, oh, it was just incredible. He was such a thoughtful and kind person, and you know, he'd explain to me like, you know, the bass drum and the hi-hat, the way that I'm playing those with my feet is just like mimicking a brass band bass drummer. And you know, he'd like do the ostinato, was like boom boom. And I was like, wow. And then, you know, he said, and I'm playing the Mardi Gras Indian tambourine patterns on the floor tom, you know, the. And I was like, what's a Mardi Gras Indian?
Okay.
And he was like, you need to go to New Orleans.
All right.
I can't explain it to you and give you the full relevance of it, or if you don't have the context. And I literally was in New Orleans in January of 1996, so like 2 months later.
Wow.
Yeah.
So giving you your directive, this is the next thing you need to do.
Yeah, I was like, yes, sir.
Okay. So, and you were finishing Berklee anyhow about that time, or you?
No, I had just started Berklee.
Oh.
That was my Christmas break. My dad.
Okay.
My dad took me to that NatPe convention.
Oh, right.
And
right.
And I remember I went to the Mermaid Lounge to see Galactic, and I took my dad and his friends, and we were there at like, you know, like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, which was like just you couldn't even, clubs didn't even stay open that late in Boston and Connecticut.
Right.
So just being out there and seeing it. And I remember seeing Stanton for the first time. And I went to see really cool story that happened was my dad said, okay, so this is before cell phones and before, you know, email and blah, 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 blah. So, my dad got me a ticket to New Orleans. He said, now look, I want when the plane lands, I want you to get your bag and I want you to go out and take a taxi and tell the taxi driver that you're going to Snug Harbor and just meet me there. And we went in, my feet landed on Frenchman Street and my dad was there at Snug Harbor. We went and saw Ellis Marsalis.
Nice. One of my teachers.
I mean, just it did not disappoint. You know, I was
sure.
I was, and one of my friends was going to Tulane that I played in high school with, one of my best friends. He's a bass player, and I was all in.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
And then I went to Jazz Fest a couple times. Once, during when I was at Berklee, and you know, of course, that was during my finals, and I came back and had to take all my finals and like 3 days, but it was, you know, it was worth it.
But now after being down for that convention, you had already decided, once I'm done with college, I'm going down to New Orleans, I'm moving down there.
Yeah.
You made that decision.
Yeah.
Nice.
But also, to let you know about, just close the loop on the Berklee thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I took a semester off, and I was infatuated with like modern and sort of traditional gospel music. So I went up to Dennis Montgomery, who was the head of the gospel department, and I said, you know, like, hey, I'd really like to, you know, play in the ensemble, and which was, you know, a little bit arrogant of me, like the best drummers, the top drummers at Berklee were doing that ensemble. And and he was like, well, if you're not enrolled, you know, you can't just like take one ensemble class and blah, blah, blah. He said, but I need a sub drummer for my brother at church on Sunday.
Oh, okay.
You want to do it? And I was like, yes. And
right?
I literally like showed up to Concord Baptist Church. It was like this huge congregation, like probably 1,500 people. And it was me and Dennis. And still probably one of the absolute best musicians I've ever played with in my entire life. And I played with some legends, and just sat down and he just started playing. Like we started like playing like, you know, shout gospel music, and right. it was just like feet to the fire. And I did that gig for like 2 years.
Nice. Immersion.
Yeah, and I never took the ensemble. I just played at church.
Well, that was probably even better, man. Just in the trenches, you know, doing it for real.
100%. 100%. Nice. And then there was Wally's in Boston, which was where I went to school with the guys from Lettuce.
Okay.
You know, like Adam Deitch and Adam Schmeens, Adam Smirnoff, and those guys, and they were just kind of starting. They had a residency at Wally's, which was this little hole in the wall jazz club, and so I got to watch Lettuce like every Sunday night play.
Nice.
And you know, it was just like the scene around. It was like a real hip scene around Boston at the time, and there were a ton of clubs, and there was just like a lot of live music happening. And, you know, even being in college, I had an opportunity to play at a lot of different venues. I played with the Czech Radio Symphony at Symphony Hall in Boston. I played with Richard Stoltzman, who's like one of the best clarinetists in the world. I played at Concord Baptist Church. I played, you know, I had a lot of really, really incredible experiences all before I graduated.
Man, fantastic.
Yeah.
I was going to say, yeah, there's not a lot of musicians in Boston, but I jest.
Well, so, making yourself available and being open.
Yeah, I mean...
And ready to go. I mean, what was it within you, do you think, that just made you so confident that you could do these things? And so ready and available to do them without fear.
I would say partially naivety.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Probably, you know, the thing about Berklee is that I think it taught you almost more than anything confidence.
Sure.
And there was a lot of like, the teachers there were like actively gigging musicians, and they were like, if you get called to do a session last minute and it's at like 2 a.m, do it, you know, because they would have Berklee would be running the studios all throughout the night. And, you know, they basically were just, it was sort of like, you can't be shy. Now, that got me into trouble in certain situations, but it also got me opportunities that I otherwise would never have had. So, you know, I think it's, you know, like obviously in hindsight, there are things that I probably would have, you know, opted to have a little bit more experience before I jumped right in. But at the same time, it's kind of like, I think as a musician especially, like, if you are able to be confident and being able to, like, keep your... I remember the first time I played with Walter Wolfman Washington, he was like... I was like 26, so I was young, and he was just like, keep your eyes open and your ears open, you know, just like look at me, you know? So I think... that there's a lot, you can cover a lot of ground if you are a musician and you are really listening.
Focused, attentive.
Focused, yes. Attentive.
Right.
If people, you know, I think really good musicians will give you good, like, body language and some, like, feedback just physically if you're paying attention to them. And as a drummer, you know, it's all about making it feel good.
Sure.
So if you can do that, and I, you know, that's one thing that I learned from playing with the Mardi Gras Indians. Like when I was playing with Monk Boudreau, I was still like learning all of the style. Like I'm 1,000 times better at playing it now than I was then, but I was coming from the approach of like, I just need to make sure that he's like dancing. And I would just look, as the drummer, you're always looking at people's backsides, you know?
Yeah.
Literally, you know, you're looking at the band. And if they are moving, and then the other thing about the other thing that's interesting about the Indians would be, playing with the Indians would be like, oftentimes if we were playing at like DBA or a small club in New Orleans, I wouldn't be able to see the audience because of the feathers. Yeah. So I would rely on the Indians themselves, like dancing and like, you know, moving their hips, and they sort of like march in place a little bit sometimes.
Right.
And I knew if I was doing that, all the other technical stuff was irrelevant.
It's going to take care of itself.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Wow, this is a fantastic story, and you're talking about getting to New Orleans. We're going to get into all that, but I think this is a good time to take a little break here. I'm going to get another cocktail for myself, get another round of some Shirley Temples for you boys. And
Arnold Palmer, we're going to Harvard.
And we'll be right back.
Mic check, 1, 2, 1, 2. Ma, walking down on by down that morning at Chihuahua. Here they come. Welcome to New Orleans, home to the eighth wonder of the world, Louisiana Mercedes, excuse me, Caesar Superdome. Home to the greatest free show in the world, Mardi Gras, at Chihuahua, Unane, Giacomo Finale. Super Sunday, fun day. Social aid and pleasure clubs. Mardi Gras Indians, extraordinaire. Coochie Mile walking down on by down that morning. Community red bean, blue plate, real mayonnaise. Coochie Mile, make no humbaw that morning. Achiwawa unane, Giacomo finane. Let them come, make no humbaw that morning. Welcome to New Orleans. Crawfish. A to fate, Achiwawa, Bawa! Uptown, where I'm from. Don't thug no trouble, there won't be none. Meet me that morning, my face painted red. Rock to the rhythm, tell them don't get scared. Here we go, the band go to bumping. Whole gang jumping, screaming and hollering, here we come. Rockin' to the rhythm, big bass drum. Load my pistol and sharpen my knife. I ain't nothing nice. I don't know what you've been told. Some like to rock, I like to roll. Giacomo Fina said, unane. Chawa, we on our way. Here we come, here we go. Whole gang jumping, we on fire, yo. Come on, Coochie Ma, power. Home to the world champions, New Orleans Saints. To the who that nation, from the wild creation. We don't bow down on that dirty ground. Achiwawa, let them come. Let's go get them.
And we're back. Back inside the Feral Zone.
Oh, I like this.
Oh, yeah. These guys are great.
This is awesome.
Back with our guest host, the great Mr. Jeff Treffinger, and our terrific guest, the great Mr. Joe Gelini.
Well, now, thanks for having me, man.
Thrilled to have you. Now, Joe, I know you're not familiar with how this podcast works, but Jeff Treffinger has been here many times, probably too many times for him, but I keep dragging him back. Okay,
good.
But, you know, this is a listener-supported operation that we have here, and, you know, to that end, we have a PayPal and a Venmo link in the show notes of every show, as well as the Facebook posts that we use to promote it. And you can our listeners, our devoted listeners, will send in contributions to those links to pay for our cocktails, pay for our Arnold Palmers, our Shirley Temples, what have you. Also in the show notes, we have the links to the Patreon page where we have our handful of patrons who are supporting us week in and week out. We love you. Also check out the Troublemen podcast t-shirts that we have the link to there, and as I mentioned last week, it's about 6 weeks till Christmas, so it's not too early to start placing your orders.
Is it six months?
I meant to say weeks, months. Who knows, Jeff? That's why I had.
I was like, fuck! I got to do some.
Well, we're in Snake and Jake, so I sort of felt like that time.
Time
war.
Is elastic here.
It's it
very,
is.
Very yes, much it's so. Relative. Yes.
I don't even know that I'm on Earth.
I know.
We're actually in a hole in the space-time continuum.
We're
in where we are.
Space station.
I've heard about these places.
Yeah, yeah. And what else? Yes, follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it. Give us 5 stars. Cost you nothing. Helps us a lot. And I want to mention a couple of dates I have coming up here. And the day that Joe's band's record is coming out, August 29th, the Katrina anniversary, your next LP is dropping that day. Well, I'll be playing a show on the North Shore with Dave Easley at Ruby's Roadhouse.
Ooh.
And he's something
Ruby's
else.
Ruby's is still there.
Ruby's
man.
Is still there, man. Yep. Dave Easley's still there.
That's so awesome.
And so I'll be doing that, August 29th at Ruby's. The next night I'm playing with Ed Volker from the Radiators. Terrific show. With Trio Mollusk will be... Saturday, August 30th at Chickiwawa.
Wow.
And then my guest host, we have a show coming up with bands, Tribe Nunzio, which is being reconstituted and we're playing a terrific show at the Broadside on September 19th.
Wow.
Yes, we are.
That's going to be
a big
show.
Those are some great bands.
I'm so blessed, Joe. God shines his face on me still.
Yeah.
He always has. It's been a continuous blessing, as they say.
Well, it's that, you know, you're a great player, so doesn't surprise me, but that's still like some choice lineup.
Yes. And I want to mention that it is Tiki Tuesday here at Snake
Tiki
Jay's Christmas
Tuesday.
Club Lounge. And,
ladies and gentlemen, Tiki Tuesday.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it's been a big hit here. You know, it's like it's the summer doldrums, and you think, well, you know, people aren't going out, they don't have anything to do. But since they started Tiki Tuesday, it's been a steady build.
Yeah.
And now we come in at 7:30 here. You got people at the bar.
Where's Martin Denny?
We love Martin Denny, but. And then here we have the duo that's always here on Tuesday nights. They have the guitar player and the chromatic button accordion. And so it has that kind of French. They're playing one of my favorite songs, the Girl Watchers theme. Nobody plays that song anymore except for these guys. I think it's actually called Music to Watch Girls By.
Nice.
Which
I love this song.
Is there any better kind of music than the music? Or I should say, isn't all music to watch girls by? So
true.
Anyway.
That's what music was invented.
That's what
true.
It was invented by.
As far
for,
as
yes.
I know.
Yeah. Okay, well, so check out those gigs, and you can find all my dates on the Renee Coleman Facebook page or, you know, iguanas.com. All right, enough of that. Back to our guest, the great Mr. Joe Gelini. Now, so Joe, you make it to New Orleans. You've been nursing at the aesthetic teat of New Orleans since you're in high school. That's a turn of phrase you weren't expecting, were you?
No, but I think it's very apropos.
Yes, thank you.
I wasn't even expecting
okay.
that.
I like to catch
and
people.
And I know you very well.
All right. You never know what's going to come out here. So you've been studying, you've immersed yourself in all these different genres, the gospel, the Mardi Gras Indian thing. You get down to New Orleans and you fall right in with the Mardi Gras Indians. Well, we're going to kind of accelerate a little bit. You don't have to go into to details. We're, you know, at this point in Snake and Jake's, you know, we're not going to stand on details.
I probably spent too much time at Snake and Jake's before that. Like, in that middle section, I was probably, like, at Snake and Jake's a lot.
Well, you know, I was going to say, I was going to point out a couple of things about Snake and Jake's and our podcast. And I would say, as a guy in recovery, which
mm-hmm.
you are,
yep.
Snake and Jake's is often like the last straw, the bottom, people's bottom, right before they go into recovery. It's more than one person. And also, this podcast has on more than one occasion been the trigger that sends people back out on a spree.
Oh God!
So,
well, I'm getting full of these Topo Chicos.
Yeah,
so I don't
yeah,
know
yeah.
if I have any
yeah, yeah.
any room in my.
Anyway,
we're gonna walk you out
gullet.
Very slowly. Yeah, and make sure you get in your car.
I'm just saying, you know, it's happened more than once. On you know, people come on the podcast, and we make it look so good that.
That's funny. Well, you should do it at the end of the. You should have it at the very end of the night when you know people are like, "No, I think I'm good."
I used to deliver pizzas here.
Oh, wow.
When it was the Christmas Club, you know, wow. lounge.
Oh, before it was Snake and Jake's.
Before it was Snake and Jake's.
I have some stories about this bar.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So let me guess. Let me just do a cold reading here. You know how the
sure.
They used to do cold readings.
We're doing psychics.
Yeah, the psychics. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Say, so, I'm gonna guess that you were here with Jun Yamagishi and Michael Ward. And I don't think Michael. I think maybe Michael was gone by then.
Yeah,
I'm guessing Jun Yamagishi and okay. Well, you tell us. Is it start with a G or a J?
Trent Reznor. Trent Reznor.
You were here with Trent Reznor.
Yep.
Yeah, there you go.
Now, how did you find yourself with Trent Reznor? Were you playing on any of those sessions?
No, I was here at the bar drinking. I had literally just, I think it was 2000. It was probably October, November of 2000. And I was found myself being belly up to the bar next to Trent Reznor.
Okay.
And Trent was, indulging.
Sure.
At the time. And I had this cockamamie idea because one of my friends that I was graduating with said he gave me a CD. And he said, if you see Trent Reznor down there, give him my CD, you know, trying to network.
Okay,
and
it's kind of a long shot, but all right.
Yeah, so I called him in Boston. I was like, hey, blah. I went out, I stepped outside. I called him. I was like, hey, man, like, what do you want me to do? Like, should I just, and he was like, yeah, I guess, I don't know. Like, just go talk to him. So he was walking out to his Porsche, and he was with a very attractive young woman. And I was like, you know, so green. I was like, Trent, kind of like waving my arms, flailing, coming up to him. And he looked at me and he goes, you were that motherfucker that was hitting on my girlfriend at the bar, weren't you? And he goes into his leather jacket to grab his gun.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, holy shit. And I looked and I just instinctually... the door was open, and I looked at his girlfriend, and I just went to extend my hand and said, hi, I'm Joe. We haven't met before. And he goes, is this the guy? And she said, no, it's not the guy. He said, oh, hey, just kidding. What's up? And he gave me, and I told him the story. I don't know how I was probably drunk, you know, and I had the gumption to continue doing that.
Right.
And then he gave
me... Well, you had the conference from Berkeley plus the alcohol, so...
He gave me his address and his phone number, and he wrote it down on a piece of paper. He said, stop by anytime. And I was basically like, no fucking way. You know, I'm like... That's way too crazy for me.
Right. Part of the magic
went from death to, dining with stars.
And then at the end of the drinking sort of movement was, years later, was basically I was here and I was, I was here with some friends and it was like, you know, the sun was coming up and I was incredibly drunk, and my buddy was hanging out with these off-duty undercover cops, which was a little sketchy to me.
Sure.
And they said, okay, let's go to Miss May's, when they kicked us out of, you know, daylight here.
Oh, geez.
And I said, I'm in no condition to drive a vehicle. And they said to me, it's okay, we will give you a police escort. But here's the only catch. You know, you'll be following us, and we'll have, you know, like the right of way. But if you rear end us, you're fucked. We're going to have to arrest you. And I was like, and my buddy's going like, do it. And I did it. It was one of the more insane things I've ever experienced in New Orleans.
That's a good story.
New Orleans finest.
Yeah, no shit. Well, you know, I was at, speaking of, I just, since you've told that story, I was at Michael Ward's house one time over in Holly Grove. And, you know, we're in his bedroom, and I was just going to be there for a little bit. But, you know, there I was, and there was a knock at the door, and he goes and opens the door. And it's inside of the house, and it's a uniformed New Orleans police officer. And I'm like, what the fuck?
At his bedroom door.
Yeah, at his bedroom door. And he goes, oh, no, it's okay. It's a friend of mine. And he comes in, and, you know, we wrapped up our business, and I left, and I told the guy goodbye, and he stayed, and he did whatever he was doing with Michael, but it's New Orleans, baby.
Yeah.
It's a different sort of gravity here.
Yep, sure is.
Well, getting back to your story, Joe, so you worm your way into the Mardi Gras Indian culture. And you go deep in. You find yourself at Indian practice with Big Chief Monk Boudreaux, and you're playing with these guys and talk about that. That must have been a dream come true.
Sure. Well, you know, everybody knows about the Wild Magnolias, and well, maybe everybody doesn't, but it's the group that started the Mardi Gras Indian funk movement.
Well, now I'm going to cut you off again because I like to do that. It's my podcast.
No, yeah. You've got the right of way.
Yes, thank you.
But don't rear end.
And you've yeah, right.
Stay. Chop it up. Chop it up, man.
Don't rear end them.
Stay heavy on the brake. well, I always like to leave a lot of room in front of me anyway. You know, I don't like to tailgate anybody. You know, you know, Quint Davis, the founder of Jazz Fest, you know, so many things he's done in his life, you know, and I always say, you know, if he'd done just any one of those, as we say in Judaism, Dayenu, it would have been enough.
Yes.
And, but correct me if I'm wrong, you've studied this more than I have, but I think the first iteration of a Mardi Gras Indian group getting together with a funk group is Wild Magnolias with Willie T, you know, Willie Turbinton, on the advice, on the suggestion of Quint Davis, you guys should play together.
Absolutely. That was
crazy, man.
Yeah, the first single came out in, I think it was in 1969, and it was actually Zigaboo on the drums, George French on the bass. Nice. And Quint put it together, and you know, as the story goes, as Quint has told me, he was in college, and he would go to these bar rooms for Indian practice and bring a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and you know, he'd record these guys, and then he had, you know, the genius idea of putting it together with a rhythm section, and eventually it was, you know, Willie T and the Gators basically backing up the Wild Magnolias and the Golden Eagles, and they called it the Wild Magnolias band.
Invented a whole genre.
Just absolutely epic. And, you know, I had gotten an opportunity to do some gigs with Monk, and I was just like, if I had gotten a gig with the Rolling Stones, it wouldn't have been better. literally, I was just like that infatuated. So, you know, I started playing with him, and eventually I became his musical director for a little bit. And I was putting the bands together.
Man.
And, you know, rehearsing the bands and, you know, learning all. I went to the source. I literally went to Louisiana Music Factory. This is back when, you know, it was needed to have CDs. And I bought everything I could find. The Wild Magnolias, the Wild Chapatulas, you know, the Donald Harrison stuff, all the sort of ancillary, you know, recordings that have been made with, like, you know, Rebirth and the Wild Magnolias. And
right.
Anyways, I dove dove into all of Monk's records, the Wild Magnolia records, the Wild Chapatulas.
And Monk is haunted. He's haunted. He's coming from when he goes into the thing, goes into the trance.
He's feeling the spirit.
Yeah.
So he and I was, you know, like I was just eating up anything that I could get from him, and he said, "You've got to learn how to play in the street." And I said, "Okay, well, what does that mean?" He said, "Well, you got to go to Mardi Gras Indian practice." And I was like, "Well, what's that?" And he said, "You got to go hook up with Geechee." And so I went to Universal Indian practice uptown. It was at Honda Wanda's. And Norwood Geechee Johnson, who was the bass drum player for the Wild Magnolias, and incidentally the first drummer that really brought the bass drum into the folds in the street, because it had been like tambourines and cowbells and bottles and whatever other shakers or percussion, you know, handmade stuff. And Honey Bannister, who's the singer in Chawa,
right,
he was running it. And I just literally brought a bass drum and stood next to Geechee and learned, like, just literally copied everything that he did. And he taught me everything that he did. And it was, you know, it's a relatively, it's sort of like the jazz in regard to like the, it's like similar to like a jazz cymbal beat. Like it is not complicated, but the nuance is profound and really can, you know, differentiate like an amateur from a master.
Right.
And his feel was absolutely incredible. And I'm still, years later, you know, I'm still realizing things that he would play from 15 years ago that I look at and I go, "Oh, that's what it was."
It's still clicking for you.
Yeah, and nice. I learned how to, like, you know, the thing about Mardi Gras Indian music is that, especially with drummers, is that it's like, it's not necessarily that challenging to play the rhythm, but to learn where the downbeat is and the pickup is with these things is like very difficult for a lot of people, even people in New Orleans, to be able to pick up, because the way that the significance of playing in the street, besides the cultural significance and the sort of like the interactions of the, you know, the Indian tribes meeting each other and the chiefs meeting each other on the street and all the different interactions like that, it's really significant because when the Indians do the call and response thing in the street, there's no one's counting you in.
Right.
And they do it in a, they'll go from like a, this is very like Berkeley technical, but they'll go from like a rubato sort of
meaning
introduction.
No time for all.
Yeah,
of
the
our,
time is like sort of free and
right. So don't have tempo yet. We're a tempo.
Yeah, they'll, you know, like, you know, like, dum bum ba da 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 ba 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 ba. I'm going downtown. I'm the big cheese. And then they'll go, "I'm going to take him downtown, hey, pocket way." So you have to, it literally starts, people get turned around all the time.
Know where the phrase starts.
Yeah, it starts on, it's a pickup on beat 4. So it goes, "Take me downtown," that's 4, and then you go into the downbeat.
One is the next beat,
But people often think, as I did when I first got there, that beat is the beat, is the downbeat, which turns the time around,
right.
You get some very sharp looks.
Yeah,
you get some looks.
I bet you do.
But yeah, I just dedicate. I mean, you know, I just was. People there were just so incredibly kind and welcoming and generous with their time.
You must have felt that when you moved down here. It's like, oh, everybody, this is how people in New Orleans behave. Just in not just musicians, but just people in general. Don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thing about it too is that there's, you know, I often say that like the tradition is innovation here, because every style of music that's been born here, which is really the epicenter of all of American music, popular music,
yes,
ragtime, jazz, you know, rhythm and blues. I mean, even going back before that, like literally, John Philip Sousa marches,
right,
you know,
right,
like pre-ragtime,
right,
all the way up to like, you know, the first, you know, Cosmo Matassa recording the first rock and roll records, yeah, you know, all the way up to bounce music and dirty, you know, South hip hop, and you know, and anything that's, you know, that's relevant today. But the thing is that tradition is innovation, innovation is the tradition, and you know, like all of these incredible styles of music, I think if you can go back and really honor the idea that to keep it alive, it has to be studied. You know, if you really respect the art form and you go back and you really dig in and you're doing it for the right reasons, I think, you know, whatever your social, religious, cultural, you know, background is immaterial if you're really approaching it and coming correct with it.
Yes, because this is all a divine pursuit, and this divine pursuit is universal. It transcends any particulars, really.
Yeah, yeah.
It's reverence.
Yes,
yes. Well, we're kind of getting to the downslope of the podcast because you have the gift of gab as to me and Jeff, but I want to get to your actual band, Chawa.
Yeah.
So you know, you guys. So you start Chawa. So you're apprenticing, or you know, spending all this time, a deep dive with Monk. You're his music director. At some point, you decide, well, I want to start a band of my own.
Yeah, it was sort of around the time I was playing. It was kind of sort of a luck in a certain way, because Monk had rejoined the Wild Magnolias, and you know, they had a famous sort of parting of the ways. So I wound up getting asked to produce Bo Dallas Jr.'s record with his dad, Bo Dallas Sr., on it, which was the last stuff that he recorded. And I actually had Monk and Bo in the studio for the last time together.
Wow.
And had them record together. And I was cutting my teeth. I'd never produced a record before. And at that point, I sort of like Chawa. It really, honestly and truthfully, it came out of selfishly wanting to play the music more, because we would have gigs, but we weren't playing every week.
It wasn't a regular gigging kind of operation.
It had, you know, we toured and we had different stuff. And like epic performances. Like I played Bo Dallas Sr.'s last, you know, final live shows, and you know, in the studio, he could sing better than he could talk, because he had had multiple strokes.
Yeah,
and it was really like, I was just like, the guy hung the moon for me.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to be in his orbit. And so by doing all that, and they gave me a lot of responsibility to sort of like, you know, write some music and produce the album and be the music director. And around that time, because I had been so comfortable, getting different people, you know, getting the players that really understood the style and the music and everything, you know, Chawa started just sort of as originally as sort of just like a personal project that I wanted to play this music as much as possible. So eventually, we, you know, sort of like we're coming up in the ranks. We started at the very bottom, and then as we started playing festivals and kind of getting a little bit more of some notoriety, playing bigger venues, you know, basically I got a great manager, and he got me a great booking agent, and then we, you know, less than a year later, we were in the studio recording our first record. And at that point, it was sort of like I gave my notice with the Wild Magnolias and Monk because it was getting too much for me to handle
sure,
the responsibility.
Sure, you can't do everything.
Yeah, so, but I have like tremendous respect for that, all those families and tribes and organizations that gave me my start, and I still look up to them
sure.
to this day. And Chawa really just started like, you know, we were getting gigs,
right?
You know, and I was starting to kind of get into the idea that, you know, it's funny because as a drummer, like one of my favorite drummer jokes is, what was the last thing the drummer said before he got fired at rehearsal? Hey guys, I've got an idea for a new song.
That's a good one.
So sort of like close the loop, you know, like all that stuff from Berkeley, which I swore I would never use
yeah.
at the time.
Okay.
I was like, I just want to play drums. I just want to be a drummer for the rest of my life. And then I had to start writing songs and music and come up with stuff like literally just out of like, all right, put out a record, got to put out another record. And then right. I was like, well, I can't just like cover Wild Magnolia,
right.
Wild Chapatulas, you know, stuff. And there's only like a handful of the call and response things that you can kind of do on like a 10 song LP.
Mm-hmm.
So I started writing and co-writing and, you know, getting more in that vein of things. And then by the second record, we got nominated for our first Grammy.
Yes.
And then we made another record and we got nominated for another Grammy. And
wow.
And then COVID happened and sort of like blew my life up. As it did with many people.
Really? That affected
you? Yeah, I don't know if you've heard of this global pandemic.
I was kind of aware of it marginally, you know. Marginally.
I was out of town.
Yeah, Jeff was mostly out of town.
Yeah.
I was out of town. I didn't see it.
Yeah. That one didn't play at our local venue, you know. So, you know, we went through some lineup changes and stuff like that. And basically I decided that I wanted to write the entire record myself. I mean, with co-writers too, but,
right.
you know, just to be able to have my complete, like the statement be completely my baby.
Okay.
And, so I got a chance to, we got a single coming out, Why You Gotta Do Me Like That, which is a song that I co-wrote with the great guitar player and producer Shane Terrio.
Sure, Shane Terrio.
And
yeah,
we were able to get Irma Thomas to come sing on it.
Nice.
Which was a, you know.
And she sounds better than ever.
Oh, my God.
Her voice sounds as good or better than it ever has.
And she came in and was like, she was a total professional.
I sure.
mean, not like... You know,
not a
her,
prima donna.
Not at all. I mean, she was like, look, I want you to give me notes. I want you to produce me. I yeah. need to get some feedback here.
Nice.
And I was like, yes, ma'am. I'm about to produce.
But you're Irma Thomas.
Yeah, totally. But we also did it with, Donnie Markowitz. We did it at his studio at Mid-City Sound.
Irish guy.
Yeah. The famous Irish Markowitzes.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you know Donnie, but he's been in New Orleans for I think over a decade now, but he comes from a very serious Hollywood background. He won the Oscar for Dirty Dancing, Time of My Life. He wrote that. I mean he's got like some legendary chops.
Sure.
Yeah, he's got a billion streams. So, like, he was there producing. He's a, you know, like,
cool.
he's my, one of my mentors.
Oh, cool.
And he was, you know, producing the vocal sessions for Irma and for John Boutte and for a lot of the background vocalists. And
so you have all these kind of great guest vocalists on this record?
Yeah. So,
very
I mean,
cool.
just working with Irma was, and John were just, like, absolutely phenomenal.
Man.
And then, you know, basically, you know, so I co-wrote or wrote or arranged every song on the record. And, you know, it's all stuff that we're talking about. We sort of elevated a little bit because, like, in the sense of, like, what the Wild Magnolias did at the time, they came out in the early 70s, and there was, like, very syncopated funk and kind of, like, disco and, like, all sorts of analog synths and this psychedelic funk stuff. And that was the music of that era, and we sort of wrote songs in the style of, like, what is contemporary to us.
Okay.
And, you know, it's not just call and response, not that there's... I mean, one of my favorite records in the world is the Monk Boudreau Live at the H&R Bar, where it's just percussion and call and response
right.
vocals. But, you know, there's only so many times you can... do that.
Right.
And
right.
So this is sort of just like, I think, the natural evolution of, you know, what's come before it.
Man, so cool. And that record's coming out August 29th.
Yep.
So you've released three singles, I guess, two under the
yep.
new singles coming out.
Yep.
The record sounds terrific. Everybody look for that. And you guys have a few dates coming up. You're going to be, looked at your dates. In September, you're playing in Boise, Idaho, and Brixton.
Yes.
London. Well,
we're also playing in Paris.
Oh, okay. Lovely. Well, I
when
feel like I'm in Paris right now.
Yeah, exactly.
When are you in Paris?
We are in Paris.
Jeff is going to be over there, so maybe he's
going to
come
see
you.
We are going to do... the New Orleans Jazz Museum has been very supportive of our cause, and Gallatin Records is part of that, and we're partnering with them
oh, cool.
on some things. And so they have this event that it's the first time that we've done it, but it's in... we'll be in Paris performing on the 19th and 20th. It's just part of the band.
Of what month?
September.
Oh, okay, 19th and 20th.
So, we're playing Paris on the 19th, 20th, and then we're playing...
Right before you go to Brixton for all the Hammer riots.
Yeah. Then we're playing on the 21st of September in London.
How was it, the Hammer riots in the 80s in Brixton? Or I was there right after them, I should say.
Yeah.
A couple of days later.
Good old days.
And then we
could really swing a hammer in Brixton.
Yeah, they could get away with murder.
Yeah. Then we come back and we're playing our album release party at Toulouse Theater.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And that's on Friday the 26th
All
of
right.
September.
Nice. And,
and
then you have a gig at Blue Nile on October 5th, I saw, with Angelica.
That was last October.
Oh, okay, sorry.
It's okay.
I'm not good with calendars.
Okay.
You know, they end and they start again.
We start again.
We are in the hole in the space-time continuum.
Right, exactly.
And here there are no
Also known as Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lunch.
So we have to wrap this up, but there's a couple of things I have to get to with you. We skipped over your whole recovery. I didn't get to hear your bottom story, all that shit, which is I love that.
We did it offline.
We'll get to that first. The ninth step, which is making amends.
Yes.
That's the one all my friends skip. The ones where they repay all the money they ripped you off.
Right.
when they were out there. They just seem to it's like, it's cool, right? It's like, it's sure, man, whatever. It's your program.
Alcoholics being alcoholics.
Sure. we can just skim over that one, right? It's like, hey, I forgot it a long time ago. This is your recovery, man.
They also have a program called Al-Anon for friends and family of alcoholics. To get over your resentment.
I don't have any friends. I only have.
I think every one of my wife's sisters has been in that.
I only have my usual host who is here. One time I mentioned that I said, Manny, we're friends. And he goes, we're not friends. He said, we're writing partners and drinking buddies.
Wow.
And I said, okay.
At least he's honest.
I guess that's true. He goes, my friends, I call up with my problems. He goes, I wouldn't call up you with my problems.
Brutal.
No, I like it. I like it. So the other, we've covered that. The other one is checking out your credits. Did you or did you not make a record with Louise Goffin?
Oh, good question.
Thank you.
I did not.
I've been doing this a while.
I did not perform on the single, but we co-wrote it.
Oh,
which was a wonderful experience.
So you were around Louise.
Yeah, no, we literally were at.
You dated Louise?
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm just getting ahead of myself.
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
I'm happily married.
You have children.
Louise is amazing.
So to those of out in radio land that don't know who Louise Goffin is, she's Carol King and Jerry Goffin's daughter. So the two Brill Building, golden children had a golden child, which is Louise Goffin, their only child.
The funny part about this is that, so I'll try to make this long story short since we got to wrap it up.
Yeah.
But basically, I went to do a show at South by Southwest. My manager at the time basically had us do a party there for the Buddy Holly Foundation. And the guy that runs that foundation, or is it the board of directors, I'm not sure what his exact role was, basically said, like, look, I'd really like to hook you up and have you go to the South Louisiana songwriting
conference.
Yeah,
right.
And this was back in 2019, and I went, and the way that they set it up is basically there are like four, basically it's like kind of Nashville style. You get four people, put them in a room, you get 25% each on the publishing, and you write a song and then you perform it that night. And so I really got into the song with Louise, and I'd come with some notes that I had, I'd written something the night before, and the subject matter was that I was writing a song about my father and his new love affair that happened with my stepmother. And they met at one of my gigs after, like, the summer after my mom died. And it was basically like, the song's called My Love Supreme. And it's basically sort of about the story of my dad. Just kind of like he at like 50 years old, he left this like incredibly successful career, retired, and like went and sailed around the Caribbean with my stepmother, and when they first got married, and just really like left of a situation that was like this very like we lived in this upper crust neighborhood with this thing and the blah 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 blah, and he really like just did his own thing and lived his life. And if you listen to the lyrics of the song, it really talks about how I think he was able to take all this pain and this terrible situation where my mother was sick for years and died, and he was able to, like, my mother told me on my back porch the year that she died, she said, "I need to tell you something. If something happens to me, I want you to encourage your dad to remarry.
Oh.
He is a wonderful, generous, kind person that deserves to have a loving partner."
Oh, man.
So
he had great parents.
So
Jesus, where do you find those?
So and that's what he did. And and actually my stepsister and I, not at the time, my stepmother is the mother of one of my best friends from high school, and I hadn't met her until after my mom died. And so we actually kind of like set them up on like a little bit of a blind date.
Very sweet.
So the song that Louise and I, and there were two other writers on it, but I was feeling myself. I was like, I'm just going to go for it, and kind of brought some of those lyrics and the subject matter. And of course, with any co-write, the magic of it is being able to have you know, the other writer take any of the ideas that you have that are, you know, that can't necessarily like coexist together, or that aren't really, you know, making sense as far as the direction or the form of the song. And we just had an absolute blast. And I had no idea who she was.
Okay.
I was literally like, at one point I was like, I like turned to one of the other writers and was like, man, this guy has like a, kind of like a Cow King sort of like tapestry kind of vibe. And like the guy looked at me and was like, right. And I called my manager and he was like, who did you wind up writing with? And I said, man, she's awesome. This incredible writer. And she's like so fun. And we had such a blast. Her name's Louise. He said, Louise who? I said, Louise Goffin. And he was like, and this is right before I'm about to go on stage with her to perform the thing in front of the entire conference. He goes, oh, you know, Goffin King. I was like, what do you mean? So he explains the thing to me. And I was just like, oh, man, I really wish you had told me after we played. Right. You know?
Couldn't you have waited half an hour? Well, that's a great story.
Thanks.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for coming and doing this. Thank you, Jeff. This has been terrific. We the whole second segment of this show was during the beautiful set that these two guys played.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah. I think it sounded just right.
Yeah, it did. It sort of was a perfect sound.
Yeah, everything makes sense in Snake.
Wherever we are, wherever universe is, you know, this is it.
Well, again, thank you so much, Joe. Everybody go look for Chawa, their new record coming out August 29th, and playing dates everywhere. And I am Renee Coleman for Manny Chevrolet, Jeff Truffinger, and the great Joe Gelini. We are signing off from Inside the Feral Zone. Good night.
Gave you a place to rest your head, let you sleep in my own bed, even gave you the shirt right off of my back. Why you wanna do me like that? Gave you every last dollar, every last dime, even made you bail when you were doing time. You turned my house right into a shack. Why you wanna do me like that? Who needs friends when you got enemies like these? Heaven help 'em, please. Well, if you don't know now, you're about to learn. 'Cause every bridge I'm about to burn, you can scream and yell, but step on back. Why you wanna do it like that? I'm gonna be your shadow every day. And if you try and run, I'll block your way. Gonna rule the day you cross this cat. Why you wanna do it like that? You wish out loud, leave the gree-gree on the ground. Why you wanna do me like that? Why you wanna do me like that? Why you wanna do me like that?